Diese Podcast-Folge wurde in englischer Sprache aufgenommen. Wenn Sie deutsche Untertitel nutzen möchten, finden Sie diese in der YouTube-Fassung dieser Folge. Der entsprechende Link ist in der Beschreibung angegeben.
Hikopod, der Wissenschaftspodcast der Historischen Kommission zu Berlin. Geschichte aus erster Hand.
Hello to all of you listening in and welcome to Hikopod. My name is Janis Bergmann and I'd like to welcome you to a new episode of our podcast. Everyone knows it. The red and yellow trains have become an integral part of Berlin's cityscape. Whether above ground or below, the Berlin S-Bahn, the suburban railway, as well as the underground rapid transit system, the U-Bahn, are the lifelines of the German capital and transport millions of passengers throughout the city every day. However, during the Cold War and the division of Berlin, the railway systems themselves were divided between East and West, while at the same time also transcending the borders within the city. It therefore played a critical role in the construction of space, the establishment of the two politically and culturally opposed halves of the city, and future urban planning in Berlin. To take a closer look at the history of the Berlin S and U-Bahn systems, today I invited an expert all the way from Sweden. Hanna Sigrist, who is researching how rail transport shaped the production of space in Berlin between 1945 and 1990 in her PhD thesis. For her project, she also won the 2024 Young Scientist Award of the Historical Commission of Berlin. Congratulations. She has studied history of sciences and ideas, as well as visual studies at Gothenburg University, where she also completed a postgraduate program in archival sciences. Currently, she is a PhD student at the Department of History of Sciences and Ideas at Uppsala University. In 2023, she was a visiting doctoral student at the Zentrum für Zeithistorische Forschung in Potsdam, and last year, a visiting doctoral student at the University of Leipzig. Welcome, or should I say, herzlich willkommen, Hanna.
Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me to this podcast.
Yeah, thank you for coming all this way, although it must be said you're living in Berlin at the time.
Yeah.
Before we dive straight into the complex history of Berlin's infrastructure, I would like to ask one thing in advance. Being from Sweden, how did you come to this German topic? And I'm doing air quotes with my hands here, which is quite local. And what fascinates you about it so much?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is that I don't quite remember how I came to this topic. Because in my memory, I have a like really clear vision of me sitting in Görlitzer Park with a friend, and it was spring, like early spring, too early spring to sit in Görlitzer Park. It was cold, maybe one of us even had a cold, and I was freezing, and I remember seeing for myself like a S-Bahn train coming into the Görlitzer Bahnhof, and me thinking, what happened to the train traffic in this city during the Cold War? And of course, this is a totally fabricated memory, because when I It's partly true because when I were in Berlin with my friend in Görlitzer Park, I was there, but I had already submitted my application to the university. So the truth is, I'm not entirely sure. But I think the truth is that I had a bit of a vague connection to Berlin because I had been there quite a lot, and my mom used to live there in the 80s. And in my master thesis, I had explored like the Swedish railway systems, but in the early 20th century. And then I became more and more interested in the Cold War, but I wanted to study Berlin for some reason. And I thought that the architect Alfred Grünander, the Swedish architect, he was a bit too much studied. And he has done like a lot of U-Bahn stations in the early 20th century. So I had to come up with another topic. So I think the truth is somewhere around there that I tried to come up with a new topic, which was related to trains, but not to Sweden. In a sense. And what fascinates me about the train system in Berlin during the Cold War is that so much about the overall Cold War conflict between the superpowers can be extracted from the train systems in the city. And this is apparently also the view of the US military and the US intelligence services during the Cold War, as they constantly monitored small changes made by the DDR state to individual S-Bahn stations in order to like draw larger conclusions about if, and in that case, when the Berlin border was to be closed.
So basically, Berlin as well as the railway systems kind of were with you throughout your whole studies.
Maybe in a way, because also the first like small thesis I wrote, and then I was really a new student, it was about Magnus Hirschfeld and his sexual institute in Berlin. So I've always been interested in Berlin in one sense or another.
Well, great. Okay, let's get straight into it then. Perhaps at the beginning, you could briefly outline what the situation of the railway and the underground in Berlin looked like after the Second World War ended in 1945, and what made the train system so special in the ensuing confrontation compared to other resources or objects or buildings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so after like the extensive bombings of Berlin in the like final battle of the Second World War, the city and also its train systems were largely in ruins, or at least that was what people thought. Architects and urban planners talked about a zero point or Stunde Null and the possibilities of rebuilding the city from scratch. They saw the potential to transform what has been like Adolf Hitler's Reichshauptstadt into a model of solid modernist urban city planning. But then it soon became clear that the total restructuring of the city was not possible, or at least not economically beneficial. Because less than a year after the end of the war, a report by the Technical University of Berlin was released showing that only 1.2% of the city's underground network was beyond repair after the war. So this meant that the absolute majority of the traffic network could be restored, and relatively easily so. And although the numbers may have not been as promising, this trend was also the same even for the overground rail systems. The basic structural elements remained and a lot could be repaired. And this was also seen as a problem, because in the GDR, the political leadership would complain that the freight traffic took up too much urban space, which they saw as a legacy of Berlin as a capitalist city under Hitler. And they were referring specifically to areas such as the Gleisdreieck in Kreuzberg, which is now a park. And to address the problem of the freight traffic, the GDR leadership wanted to build a train line around Berlin. And this was an ambition that they took over from Hitler's architect Albert Speer, who had already started such a construction. So paradoxically, the socialist city of Berlin was to be established through the completion of a rail line that had begun to be built during the Nazi era, but it has also been planned even during the Weimar Republic for military purposes. In my thesis, I argued that the work on the ring line, the so-called Berlin Ausending, was deeply integrated with the GDR protectionist project of the Berlin Wall. It was only when this outer ring line was completed that Walter Ulbricht was finally able to convince the Soviet leaders to close the border in Berlin. And that's how I think that the train systems differ from other communication systems in the city. The layout and the operation had a direct impact on the Cold War, and that on several occasions. This was particularly true in the context of the Berlin blockade in 1948, when the Soviet Union initiated a total disruption of the train systems, and that in order to starve out West Berlin. And it was even more true in the following railway strike, the so-called Ugo-Putsch, when railway workers in West Berlin organized themselves into the Unabhängige Gewerkschaftsorganisation to get their wages paid in Western Deutsche Mark. The Allies followed the strike closely in order to support the strikers if necessary. And in that way, the train systems were like an integral part of the Cold War.
Yeah, so you can really see how the train system was important for the political leaders on both sides from the very beginning, basically. In the working title of your thesis, you call the confrontation within the divided city Berlin Space Wars. Could you elaborate a bit on that term and the underlying concept in the context of your research?
Yes, of course. So the concept Space Wars, it was introduced as a theoretical concept in the social sciences and the humanities by the sociologist and philosopher Sigmund Bauman. And Bauman used the term to signify the processes by which the modern state took control of spatial aspects of social life by producing and mastering ideas of objective spatiality. And by projecting these ideas onto their territories, states were able to extend their dominance over space as such, or as Bauman writes. Before, it was the map which reflected and recorded the shapes of the territory. Now it was the turn of the territory to become a reflection of the map, to be raised to the level of orderly transparency, which the maps struggle to reach. And as I see it, Berlin provides a particularly important example for the study of state dominance over space. Berlin as a city was a location claimed not just by one state, but by several states. And not just one state wanted to reshape the city to conform to predetermined maps and models, but multiple states. Not just one, and now I'm quoting Bauman, supercommunal state rule administration established their bureaucratic seat in the city, but several. The territorial claims were, in the words of Bauman, not characterized by their singularity or Einheitlichkeit, but by ambivalence or even multiplicity. Berlin was ultimately a place where conflicting imperialist ambitions disguised as plans for city or traffic planning were clashing. Therefore, the city of Berlin was especially well suited as a projection surface for the modernist and critical urban planners who sought to construct cities that would not merely represent the world, but rather change its social and political conditions. To do just that, these urban planners looked for places where it was possible to start from the beginning. The modernist notion of the zero point, as I mentioned before, the Stunde Null, made a shattered post-World War II Berlin a particularly attractive city for new visions. By focusing the study on Berlin's traffic planning as an expression of a more overarching spatial conflict, that is, of an ideological confrontation centered around the city as a contested place, that both territorially and conceptually. I thus examine the Cold War at the local level. The premise of my study is, in other words, that the central spatial claims that structured the Cold War can be found in small details, such as planning along the demarcation line between East and West. This assumption is what the concept space wars in Berlin captures for me. So, the concept of space wars includes, as I use it, the concrete and although Cold War that took place in Berlin, and it also describes conflicting state and municipal claims to the city. I have also chosen to frame my study with the concept because it alludes to the space race that took place in the space during the Cold War, which I hope to touch upon at least briefly in my thesis.
So you can basically see the bigger conflict within a very small and local framework. I think that's always really, really interesting because it makes it easier to grasp than a whole conflict on a global scale. So with the division of Berlin, many of the train lines were interrupted, of course. Continuous traffic, as before, was no longer possible. And that also made reconstruction or construction and expansion of infrastructure more difficult, obviously, and had a huge impact on urban planning in general. So how did this influence the city space and the development of Berlin as a whole?
So in a way, the division of the transport networks had already started before the Berlin Wall was built. And generally speaking, West Berlin's municipality transport company, BVG, controlled the U-Bahn system with the exception for a few lines within the East Berlin. And the DDR-controlled Deutsche Reichsbahn was in charge of the S-Bahn system in the entire city. So however, as a result of the wall, the differences between the two parts of the city and their transport systems increased. In West Berlin, Willy Brandt encouraged citizens to boycott the S-Bahn system, reduce the flow of currency into the GDR, and by extension, as he said, to the financing of the Berlin Wall. Over the time, the S-Bahn system in West Berlin was falling apart. The GDR state could not afford to keep it in good condition. So the paint on the walls was peeling, the trains were running with outdated braking systems, and the cast iron beams holding up the platform roofs were rusting. At the same time, architecturally and innovative and well-invested U-Bahn stations were built in West Berlin, so the contrast were really huge. After the Berlin Wall was erected, the two train systems developed in different directions, and even literally so. In East Berlin, lines were extended to the east and to the north, to Tierpark in Friedrichsfelde, to Marzahn and to Hohenschönhausen. And in West Berlin, the U-Bahn lines went west and south to Altmariendorf, Spandau and Steglitz. In other words, the S-Bahn and the U-Bahn were treated as two entirely separate systems. But the fact is that the spatial division of the city had already begun before August 13 in 1961. The Berlin Wall was just the end of a longer process of separation. The years 1953 and 1957 were particularly important for this separation to happen. In 1953, for example, checkpoints were established for car and pedestrian traffic in the city, and thereafter, the train system was the only means of travel free from extensive control measures in Berlin. In 1957, passport controls were intensified on the S-Bahn, and from, I think, November of that year, the DDR Ministry of Interior forbade state employees from traveling to West Berlin unnecessarily, as it was called. If they did so, they risked losing their jobs. So one could say that for government employees, the city was already divided into two parts in 1957.
And with all these divisions and changes, who were the main actors and driving forces on both sides behind the planning and or measures taken to shape the railway systems, as well as the city, in accordance with the corresponding political beliefs? So what were some of the ways they instrumentalized the infrastructure to enforce their ideology?
I would say, like, in the beginning, immediately after the Second World War, the German exiles who returned from Moscow were, I would say, the driving force behind the transformation of the Berlin into a city that would resemble Moscow, using their railways as a means. And in particular, Erwin Kramer, who later became the DDR's Minister of Transport and who had strong ties with Walter Ulbricht, was the prime actor in this matter. While the exiles wanted to build a new Berlin, whose structure would be determined by the railroad, Stalin had large parts of the railroad network dismantled, and he moved railway material to the Soviet Union as damage repair after the war. This fact shows that it was precisely the exiles and not the Soviet leadership or not Stalin who had the ambition to make Berlin their future capital, and who was most clearly envisioned Berlin as a capital of a future socialist state. Over time, the railway would become less important to the DDR's claims over Berlin, or important in other ways. For example, during the Honecker era, the S-Bahn network in East Berlin came to be increasingly depicted according to a Western model, that is, by toning down the monumental ring shapes of the network while emphasizing straight lines according to the principles of cybernetics instead. This was done on line maps and also on information sheets without any major changes, if any, being made to the actual transportation networks. And this change could be interpreted as Erich Honecker's attempt to give GDR citizens a taste of West or something like that. In West Berlin, things were different. The overall ambition of the U-Bahn network was double. On the one hand, to create the underground services that were independent of the DDR, and on the other hand, to maintain the vision of the reunification of Berlin that was the constant promise of the Western powers during the Cold War. Based on the so-called 200-kilometer plan, which was established in 1955, Berlin's future was more or less determined within West Berlin Sandbau. The plan was revised in the following decades, but the basic idea remained the same. The Berlin U-Bahn network as a whole was to be expanded from 80 to 200 kilometers of lines, with no fixed time frame, however. The upcoming reunification existed as a powerful argument for prioritizing certain U-Bahn lines over others. For example, the U7 underground line was given a temporary end station in the Rudow district, so that the line could later be extended in reunified Berlin to the DDR Schönefeld airport. As anyone who lives in Berlin today knows, this temporary end station is still the end station of the U7 line. But you asked me about how they instrumentalized the infrastructure. And I would say that the very concept of infrastructure, which gained its modern meaning in the NATO military rearmament program, was perhaps the most powerful weapon of the Western powers to instrumentalize ideology in relation to transport system during the Cold War. And this also in Berlin. While the DDR state was more active in transforming the physical urban landscape, the Western powers focused more on transforming the very conceptualization of transport systems. The concept of infrastructure was theorized to a large extent during the golden age of the SPD party, in West Berlin, but also in the West German state, around the turn to the 1970s. Transport systems then began to be understood as infrastructures that would generate and guarantee economical growth. A theory that was, of course, ideological and that still has a strong impact on us today. Parallel to the study of physical restructuring of the city of Berlin, I tried to trace changes in the concept of infrastructure from a concept of NATO military rearmament to denoting systems that are seen as invisible or naturalized until they break down or stop functioning. In my thesis, I argued that the infrastructure theories of the 1990s and early 2000s were inevitably shaped by the fact that the concept of infrastructure had been tied together with the ideas of transcendence and thus by the notion of territorial border crossing as the primary aspect of the systems that came to be denoted by the concept of infrastructure. As such, these theories were partly shaped by the very liberal ideology that emerged victorious from the Cold War, and by extension by the Die Wende and the fall of the Soviet Union, although in different ways. Therefore, I argue that the definitions of infrastructures from the 1990s as systems that transcend spatial boundaries and as systems that could not be modified from above, that is, by the state. Both these statements are according to Susan Lee Starr's and Geoffrey Bowker's influential definition. I argued that these theories rather expressed the governance that surrounded the systems after the fall of the wall, but it bluntly the self-image of the liberal democracy.
So during the early years, basically, the infrastructure was just viewed by the military as an important part and not in like economical circles.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. In the beginning, infrastructure meant basically rearmament of NATO. It was the word they used.
Were streets viewed differently as railways, or was it basically the same thing as like lines?
That's a great question. I would say like when the SPD took over the notion of infrastructure, they also referred to streets because infrastructure meant in this context, like the term has a longer history. And in the beginning, it referred to like fixed element of the railway systems. And that is, I think, in the later part of the 19th century. But then, as NATO took over the term, they referred to infrastructure as solid elements of the military complex. And then for the SPD, infrastructure meant like solid elements for guaranteeing economical growth. And that would be like hospitals, schools, streets, and also the train systems.
Okay, thank you for this outline of the development of the infrastructural concept and the train system within the city. As historians, we are obviously most interested in sources. And you have been in Germany as a visiting doctoral student for many months. I'm assuming a lot of the time was dedicated to visiting archives and sifting through heaps of documents and other types of sources. So which archives were the most important for you, and what types of sources do you mainly use for your research? Was there a certain find that really surprised you or maybe has opened a completely new aspect in your project?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I have definitely been a lot to the archives, and I would say that the absolute majority of my sources come from the GDR's Ministerium für Verkehrswesen, because I see the GDR state and before that the exiles who came back from Moscow under the leadership of Walter Ulbricht as being the forefront of what I call the Berlin space wars. They were the ones who most clearly sought to restructure the physical urban landscape using railroads as a means. And of course, train systems, the U-Bahn, were also expanded in West Berlin, but then the goal was rather to create good travel opportunities for West Berliners independent of the GDR-controlled S-Bahn system. In West Berlin, the U-Bahn system was seen as an architectural project, which was clear from the fact that it was developed under the Senatsverwaltung für Bau und Wohnungswesen. The ambition was, in addition to guaranteeing travel possibilities, to create hypermodern aesthetic spaces, which is still evident today for the traveler going to, for example, Spandau with the line U7 or Steglitz with the line U9. And, for example, the U-Bahn station Feberliner Platz with its pop architecture in orange, red and green is a great example of this. But of course, I have also consulted the sources from the West Berlin Senate Department. But to really get an insight into how the train systems were incorporated into the Cold War, I also had to consult alternative sources, especially from the victorious powers, the US and the UK. And I have not been to the French archives since I don't read French. But in the US, I have mainly collected material from the US mission to Berlin, that is from the US military administration, and in the UK, mainly from the foreign ministry. And I have also found useful sources at the Stasi Unterlagenarchiv and in the archives of the SED party. So yeah, I have spent most time in the Bundesarchiv and the Landesarchiv in Berlin. But in addition, I've also been to like a small visit to Bundesarchiv in Koblenz and also to the National Archives in London and Washington. And when it comes to like a big find, I had that experience in Washington. It was like one of the first days. I don't remember. It was actually the first day in Washington or the second day. And it might have been like the result of some jet lag. But I clearly like remember myself physically shaking because I was so shocked about the document that I read. And what is said was that a high-ranking official of the Reichsbahndirektion Berlin was acting as a spy for the Americans. And I was so genuinely surprised. And like in retrospect, I think that this reaction was a bit like over the top because of course there were spies everywhere and it could be expected. But there was something about having spent so much time in the archives in Berlin, like months, and then coming to the US and get this like information the very first day. It didn't revolutionize like my entire project, but it made clear to me how the archives we use really like affect the research in a way, and also like how interested the Americans were in the train systems in Berlin and how like strictly they tried to follow what happened with especially the S-Bahn in order to understand the intentions and ambitions of like the GDR state and also the Soviet Union.
I think especially within the divided Berlin, it's really important to take into account the victorious powers as well, which sometimes gets overlooked a bit and people just focus on East and West Germany. But yeah, it tends to be forgotten that the victorious powers were till 1990 always in the background or foreground as well. So to conclude our conversation, I would like to take a look at the aftermath. How did the development of Berlin's separate railway systems shape the city after its reunification? And what influences from that era had a lingering effect that maybe can be felt even until this day?
Yeah, so the reunification was a very active project in the area of trains and subway systems under the Allianz für Deutschland. Something that today could be described as a form of Rückbau was carried out, although this was not a word used then in the 90s. Instead, politicians talked about closing gaps. And this could mean like removing protective walls as the Friedrichstraße border station or connecting platforms that had previously been separated. So the traces of the Cold War are almost everywhere in the train and underground systems. For those who pay attention, they can be seen, of course, in the greater extent of U-Bahn lines in West Berlin than in East Berlin, and vice versa with tram traffic, because, of course, the decision to build underground in West Berlin was highly ideological, with the aim to make room for individual cars. But there's one particular detail of the S and U-Bahn systems that, at least to me, stands out as a clear reminders of how today's train systems were shaped during the Cold War. And it's in the Märkisches Viertel district, because anyone who wants to get to Märkisches Zentrum today has to take the S-Bahn or the U-Bahn to the Wittenau station and then walk about 800 meters or take a bus. And this seems like a fundamentally strange and irrational urban planning. And that's of course because this wasn't the original intention. The plan when the urban district was established was for a U-Bahn line to run all the way to Märkisches Zentrum. But as West Berlin's finances ran out, since the construction of the U7 to Spandau was much more expensive than planned, but also because of the oil crisis, and as West Berlin took over the Western S-Bahn network in 1984, the U8 line to Märkisches Viertel was never completed. Today, BVG is again planning to complete the line. I think it's expected to be finished by 2039, that is in 15 years from now.
Yes, so you can still see how the history of the division of the city is still visible today. If you look at the infrastructure, if you look at certain train lines, and especially if you look at maps, you can still see the old borders. So if our audience now would like to learn more about the history of the Berlin S and U-Bahn system during the Cold War, do you have any tips for literature or perhaps certain locations that are especially interesting to visit in the context of the Berlin Space Wars?
So I would say that the best book on the subject is by Burkhard Ziesler, and it's called Aus der Osten durch den Westen vor, and it was published in 2006. And this book gives like great insight into how the Deutsche Reichsbahn and thus also the S-Bahn was controlled by the DDR during the Cold War. And one obvious destination for tourists and others is of course the exhibition in the Tränenpalast at Bahnhof Friedrichstraße, the departure hall built especially for travelers who had the opportunity to move across the border during the Cold War, and that was mainly travelers from West Berlin to East Berlin. And this is, I would say, a good exhibition, but I would still argue that the most important location for Berlin Space Wars is slightly outside of Berlin in Potsdam, and it's only accessible by regional trains, and that is the railway embankment over the Lake Havel, along the line between Samund and Golm. With great effort, the DDR state managed to complete the embankment in 1956, I think, maybe 57, and thus also completing the Berlin Außenring. Shortly after the ring line was opened for so-called commuter traffic, Berufsverkehr, that is for government employees who were no longer allowed to travel across West Berlin, Nikita Khrushchev issued his ultimatum to the Western powers to make Berlin a demilitarized free city, an ultimatum that a few years later led to the Berlin Wall. Today, the regional train 22, I think, runs between Samund and Golm, and that around once every hour, at least Monday to Friday. Yeah.
In best cases.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. That brings us to the end of today's episode, and I would like to thank you again for coming here and for the insight into your project, Hannah.
Thank you for having me.
If you would like to find out more about the work of the Historical Commission of Berlin, you can visit our website hico-berlin.de or take a look at our YouTube channel. Otherwise, thank you again for listening, goodbye, and until the next episode of HicoPod.